Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. A lot of creepy things can happen in old houses, and author Joseph Covey takes a look at one at an estate across Lake Champlain in New York. It's the first book in his three-part series called Psychotherapy with Ghosts. Book one is Quiet Room, and Joseph Covey is here to discuss it with me. Joseph, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Joseph a question about his book, or if you've read it and want to comment on it, you can give us a call at 244-1777. 877-291-8255 is our toll-free number. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Joseph, what got you started writing the Psychotherapy with Ghosts series?
I had an odd experience in my stepdaughter's home 7 years ago. It was kind of a spooky thing. She lives in an old building in New Hampshire, built in 1822. You know, old houses like that, they're noisy. You can't make a move, but that floors creak, and you can hear anything that's going on. But I was in bed very early one morning around dawn, had a distinct impression someone walked into the room, no sound, walked into the room, stood over me, looked at me for a minute or two, straightened up, and walked out. So that got me thinking. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm blind, so even if I opened my eyes, I wouldn't have seen anything. But I'm also a psychotherapist, and I have an intensive interest in the 19th century. So on my way home, I just had this idea in my mind. What would it be like to talk to someone, have a live conversation with someone who was living in 1840 or 1830? And what would it be like to do psychotherapy with such a person? Why would they be a ghost? What would be the sort of underlying causes of that? So that's how it all got rolling.
Wow. And
now I'm on your program.
Yeah, see, just like that. Now, yeah. The first of this three-part series is called Quiet Room, and that's what's out now. So what is this specific book about? And no spoilers, but what are the themes, you know, that matter most to you? And something about the story would be great.
Okay, well, let's see. I would say, you know, on the surface, Quiet Room is... it's a love story. It's a ghost story. It's a mystery. And it is all those things. But it is also about more serious things, too, such as man's relationship with God, relationships between men and women. I don't know about you, but they're not always easy, okay?
No,
so,
they're not.
You know, relationships between men and women. The question of children, the question of controlling our impulses, and what happens when our impulses get the better of us. So it's about all of those things. The setting is, in fact, mostly, at least in the first book, Quiet Room, set at an abandoned early 19th century building on the New York side of Lake Champlain, ostensibly someplace around Willsboro.
Right.
The story is constructed in two parallel plots, and I would say that the primary plot is about takes place in 1970. It's about a New York City psychotherapist, psychologist, who quits his practice, intends to start his life over as an antique dealer, what he should have done all along, and buys this abandoned property against the advice of his fiancée, his parents, everyone. Buys this abandoned property, moves into this house, and discovers that not only is it full of antiques, but one of the rooms is haunted. And he finds himself, against his better judgment, sitting up at night with the ghost of a lovely young lady.
So, and that is,
you
might
imagine,
the room itself is the quiet room.
And that's the quiet room.
Yeah.
Now, every other chapter is written more in the style of, let's say, a Gothic romance novel, and explains what happened in 1840 to lead this lady trapped as a ghost in 1970.
And each chapter tells you where you are, what date it is. Of course, it's, you know, it's there in nice bold type that I just ignore. And I'm reading, and I'm getting into a few chapters. I'm like, wait, what? And I have to go back and check the dates. It's like, oh, because you're flipping back and forth between the 1800s and 1970, which is really kind of neat, these two time periods.
I want to mention that. I mean,
yeah.
Each chapter is clearly dated.
Right.
So it's not within the chapter. There's no switching back and forth within chapters.
Right.
If you're in a chapter, it's either 1970 or it's 1840.
Yeah. It takes you a few minutes to pick it up. It takes slower people like me a few more minutes than usual to pick up what's going on. But it's not that confusing. You just, you know, your mind takes you back and forth every other chapter between the 1800s and the 1970s. So pretty cool. Did you prefer, Joseph, writing about one period over the other?
I would say no, although I personally have very strong interests in that pre-Civil War, early 19th century period.
Yeah.
You know, earlier in my adult life, when I had ordinary eyesight, I was an antique dealer. I was a very active collector of antique photography, antique hand-sewn clothing, antique prints, you know, all that, all those antique smalls and larges, right?
Right.
Furniture to eyeglasses. And that way of life really became inaccessible to me once I lost my eyesight. So that plot, that 1840 plot, I suppose it was a way for me to re-immerse myself in that sort of thing.
It is fun for someone who's not lived in the 1800s to read those chapters and get a really a very descriptive look at what 1840 was like. Especially you have a scene in Burlington. And to be thrust into, you know, whatever it was, 1839, I think, and 1840 in Burlington, it's pretty fascinating to get that snapshot that you provide in the book.
Yeah, you know, that chapter, I know the one you're talking about, and I think it's the second chapter, so it's only 3 pages or 4 pages into the book. But it takes place in May of 1838 when the Catholic Church on what is now Pearl Street was burned down by a mob. That's a real event that did happen. There was a lot of anti-Catholic, what they would call anti-Popish or Roman sentiment, you know, afoot in the country at that time. Yeah. It was a different, Burlington was at that time a very busy, really shipping port, seaport. You know, Lake Champlain was like the closest thing to a super highway running from the St. Lawrence all the way down to Albany and New York City. So it was very active. I mean, we look out on the lake today, you might see a boat, you might see a sailboat.
Right.
If it's a nice day, but not necessarily. In those days, if you looked out on Lake Champlain at any time of the year, there would have been maybe dozens of sails. There was even a daily stagecoach run between Willsboro and Burlington during the winter months. What they would do is they would put sleigh runners on the stagecoach. And you know, at Willsboro, the lake gets really narrow. So that would freeze early.
Right.
And they would load up the stage, run quickly across the frozen part of the lake, and then run up the shore where the lake was frozen solid. And they would run up to Burlington, and then they would run back to Willsboro. And it was all in a sled on the lake.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now, the setting you've chosen, as you've mentioned, Willsboro, it's an old estate on Lake Champlain in New York. Did you have a certain place in mind as you, you know, worked? And also, you know, why not the spot that you originally had that kind of feeling of an apparition in New Hampshire?
Because I live here.
Fair enough.
I don't live in New Hampshire. I live here.
All right.
There's something. I like the lake. And I had been when years and years ago, and I'm talking about, in the mid to late 80s, I had taken a trip out here. I was ordinary eyesight in those days.
Uh-huh.
And I remember taking the Charlotte Ferry over to, I think it's Essex, New York. And I just fell in love with it. I mean, Essex is one of these, it's one of these towns that was alive in 1830. And as soon as railroads came through, the Lake Champlain traffic really died down. And by the Civil War, there was nothing going on. So Essex is sort of this, it's this town frozen in the 1820s, 30s, all these beautiful stone buildings. Built right up on the sidewalk in the style of the time. And I had that in mind. It made a big impression on me at the time. I've come across a few towns like that in the United States. And you know what? They're usually on waterways or canals, which have since fallen into disuse. New Lisbon, Ohio is another one. Go to New Lisbon. There's no reason to have a town there anymore.
Wow.
And you drive in, and there's these brick buildings, and they're clearly built 1815, 1820, 25. They're just frozen in time.
And we've got a call from Stephen in Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Rick.
Morning.
This is a story that may be of interest to the author and to yourself.
Okay.
My grandfather was a psychoanalyst in Baltimore in the early 1900s, and he had studied for a year in Switzerland with Carl Jung, and he had quite a few patients in Baltimore. So in the summer, he would put them all on a steam train, or a lot of his patients, and they would go to New York from Baltimore. And then they'd take another steam train from New York to Whitehall.
Oh.
And then at Whitehall, they'd get on the Ticonderoga Ferry. And each of them had a stateroom. So they went overnight up Lake Champlain to Plattsburgh.
Uh-huh.
And in the morning, they'd get on a steam train to Lion Mountain in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And there they'd get a horse coach down to Lake Chateauguay. And there was a steamboat that went around the Lake Chateauguay, once a week. And there were no roads at that time, but he had a camp on the west side of Lake Chateauguay with 11 sleeping cabins and actually 23 cabins in all, a dining room and woodshed and shop and boathouse and all kinds of boats. So anyway, they went there for the summer, and they did early what they call tea groups now, which are personal interaction, which was the only kind of psychotherapy that they really had at that time.
Wow. Well,
anyway, so they'd stay there for 3 or 4 months.
All right, Stephen, I want to hear from Joseph react to that, because go ahead, Joseph.
Well, a couple of things come to mind.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Steve. The couple of things come to mind. You know, the Adirondacks have been a summer getaway resort since the early 19th century, particularly the region around Saratoga Springs because of what they called the waters there.
Right.
Right? Saratoga Springs was the in crowd's place to be every summer, starting about 1800, in fact. So there was a lot of activity, and you're describing a lot of the route that people would have taken at the time. You also mentioned when you first called about Carl Jung, and so that perked up my ears. You know, in this 1970 plot, the psychotherapist is educated in sort of a traditional Freudian way. And because of that, he's also a confirmed atheist. Freud was an atheist. And that has had really a tremendous influence on psychology as it is today. So psychology as it is today doesn't really accept the existence of the paranormal or of God or of a spiritual aspect. Now, Carl Jung, a protege of Freud's, sort of his right-hand man, was very interested in what Freud called mysticism. And in fact, the two of them had this tremendous split over that issue. So this Freud-Jung dichotomy or this Freud-Jung tension is present in the novels. This psychologist is trying to interpret the events that are going on in a Freudian way. It doesn't really work. And he finds himself being forced to accept that there is some mystical or, well, spiritual part to life. And if there's a spiritual part to life or what would we call supernatural, right? So the natural would be the material world, but if there's a supernatural world, something beyond the material, boy, it's not a big leap to think, well, you know what? You can't believe in ghosts and not believe in God. Hmm. It makes it hard for him to maintain his atheism. I'm not a religious guy, so I'm not proselytizing.
Right.
But I do think that these, you know what it is? These are things that I think about all day long.
Well, Joseph, this is your first novel. So what was the hardest part of writing this particular book?
Showing it to my wife.
Oh.
Honestly speaking, starting it and getting over this feeling that every word I wrote down somehow exposed me. Hmm. And, you know, it's fiction. So I guess in some absolute way, that's true. Every character is my creation, something I pulled out of my ear. So are all of these characters somehow representative of material that's within my mind?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
But you know what? I found I just had to get over that. So by the time I let my wife even know what I was doing, I was probably 30 or more pages into this. I didn't really intend to write a novel. I don't know what I intended to write. I was just this idea of doing psychotherapy with a 19th century person, and it would have to be a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
It captivated me so much. I started writing this thing down, and one night I just said, you know, Donna, that's my wife. You know, Donna, something I have to tell you. I think she was getting ready for some other. I've been writing this story, and I just want you to hear it. And I was kind of, my big fear was that she was going to say something like, boy, you are one sick puppy, or this is stupid, or something like that.
Right, right.
But she didn't say anything like that. She said, that's kind of neat.
Wow. Like,
keep with it. And so I did. And she was a tremendous encouragement.
Oh,
as I would
lovely.
Finish a chapter, I'd force her to sit down and listen to it.
Yeah. Well, Joseph, as a psychotherapist, how does using psychotherapy differ when you're working with ghosts than with your living clients?
You know what? In quiet room, it doesn't differ tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's trying to use conventional psychotherapeutic methods to treat someone who is clearly anxious, depressed, has all of the common sort of, disorders or problems. I don't like to call them disorders. Problems with daily living, right, which we all have.
Mm-hmm.
And the spirit has those problems. Now, he helps her to work through those things for sure. But you know what? Of course, he doesn't, in the first book, get to the real reason why she's trapped between life and afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
So in the first novel, the psychotherapy is much as psychotherapy would have been conducted in 1970. I was careful to the way that it was done true to the period with references of that sort. But as the story goes on, the psychotherapy sessions become more addressing her rift with God. And because of that, because of it forces him to confront his own sort of spiritually vacant life and his own frozen emotions. The psychotherapist in this story is—he's a guy who—he's not really great at interpersonal relationships. You know what? He's like a lot of psychotherapists. I know one myself. Okay, they're really introverted people. They're very uncomfortable in unstructured relationships. Put them in a room with 15 people and have them be the instructor or in charge, and they're just fine. Mm-hmm. Put them in a room with 15 people and have it be a party. Oh, you know, they're like, can we go home now?
Can we go home then? Right. Yeah.
So he's much like that. And he uses, or through the course of his therapy with the spirit, he starts to understand not only that he has these problems, and they cause problems for him in his real life, but what may be at the heart of those problems. So they both get their house in order.
Mm-hmm. Joseph, you certainly have piqued listeners' curiosity about the book. Where can people find Quiet Room?
Well, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Phoenix Books. Good. I'm doing everything I can to interest every independent bookstore in the state. I've been contacting each and every one of them. Every independent bookstore in the state. But I know for a fact you will be able to find it at Phoenix, both in Essex Junction and Burlington. And at Barnes & Noble in South Burlington and on Amazon.
And you mentioned that by the end of Quiet Room, still questions, and there are two more that I know of books in the Psychotherapy with Ghosts series. When will the next be out? And do you have a title yet on that one?
Oh, yeah. All three books are written.
Ah.
The second book is titled Female Academy, and it comes out February 1st of next year. The third is titled Conventional Afterlife, and that release date is yet to be scheduled.
All right. Well, we'll keep in touch and let everybody know when that happens. Joseph Covey is an author and psychotherapist. His three-part series is called Psychotherapy with Ghosts, and book one is Quiet Room, published by New Link Publishing. Joseph, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Hey, when can I come back on?
Well,
I'm
probably
talking about this.
We'll talk. All right, we got to take a break here, going to CBS News, and we'll come back to talk about an organization that's been helping families in central Vermont navigate family life for 30 years.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. The author, Anita Diamant, once said, "It's a good thing babies don't give you a lot of time to think. You fall in love with them, and when you realize how much they love you back, life is very simple." That may be, but life is simpler and more manageable with support, especially as you begin your journey into parenthood. Good Beginnings of Central Vermont has been helping families navigate family life for 30 years, and here to tell us about how they do it and the services they provide is their executive director, Gretchen Elias. Gretchen, thanks for being with us this morning.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question about Good Beginnings of Central Vermont, or if you want to share how you use their services, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. As I mentioned, Good Beginnings has been operating in Central Vermont for 30 years. Can you tell us a little bit about the history? Take us back to the start.
Sure. Yes. Well, we are a very homegrown Central Vermont organization. We were started in 1991 by three mothers in Northfield. And these three moms had all taken classes in child development and psychology at Norwich, and also recognized that in modern American life, families get very little support when they are sent home from the hospital, often 24 or 48 hours after giving birth with a new baby. And so they felt the need to create a system of community support. And we've been doing that core model of training community volunteers to support families with new babies for 30 years.
And how has it grown from those three moms back then?
Well, for many years, it was literally run by the founder out of her kitchen in Northfield. But for the past 8 to 10 years, we've had an office in Montpelier. We now have three staff members, and we also have, and obviously everything is a little bit different during COVID, but
sure,
our office in Montpelier has a parent drop-in space that has been very, very popular with new families. We opened that about 7 years ago, and so we're looking forward actually to reopening that over the next few months, summer and fall. And so what we've really done and grown in the past 7 or 8 years is providing more of a community space and hub for new parents in addition to the in-home support, sort of, because families need both.
Yep. And Gretchen, what is the mission of Good Beginnings?
We bring community to families and their babies.
How?
The first 3 months when you're home with a new baby, with an infant, whether you've adopted or whether you've given birth or whether you're the non-birthing partner, those first 3 months can be really, really isolating. So our core program, as I mentioned, is a community matching program where we match a family with a trained community volunteer, and they go and visit the family in the home once a week for the first 12 weeks after that baby becomes a member of that family. And that's the core service we provide. And then we pair that up with other ways for families to build community in those precious early months when they're adjusting to this new world of life with a baby. So we have, as I mentioned, our Nest parent drop-in space where we organize peer support groups and meetups for parents. And we provide support with baby wearing, which is a really great and important tool for folks who are caring for new babies, because it benefits the baby and the caregiver at the same time. When you hold your baby close, that benefits the baby's development in terms of having a secure attachment to a caregiver, and it makes you hands-free. It means you can get other stuff done and move around your house, and the baby can nap on your chest while you do the dishes or play with an older child. So we do a lot of support for new families around baby wearing and other kinds of skills like that to help them have a more resilient first 3 months.
Gretchen, how did you get involved with Good Beginnings?
Well, I joined the organization about 5 years ago. My background is in community development and community building. So that was one of my main interests in wanting to join Good Beginnings. But I was also a mom who really struggled in the first 12 months after my daughter was born, my eldest child. I wasn't diagnosed with perinatal mood or anxiety disorder, but when I look back at that, I kind of wonder whether maybe I should have been diagnosed with that. A lot of folks are afraid to ask for help or aren't, it can be stigmatizing to admit that you're struggling. And so I had this personal experience of feeling like it was very hard, feeling confused, feeling angry and overwhelmed. And you're told by society that you're not supposed to feel that way, right?
Right.
And for me, it lasted for the first year, really, which is also very common. It's not people think it's only, you know, the first 6 weeks and then you're fine. So I had that personal experience, which really made me connect with the mission and appreciate the role that Good Beginnings plays for families in Central Vermont.
What and who are the postpartum angels?
That's what we call our volunteers. And I have to give a shout out to a mom that we supported twice. Once with her first child many years ago, and she was a single mom at that time. She's a local author and poet, and she wrote a lovely piece about her experience with that volunteer when she was a single mom, and she said it was like having her own personal angel. So that's we with her blessing, that's what we call our volunteers. We call them postpartum angels because they are coming to provide support, a listening ear, companionship. You know, they're not professionals. They're not there as social workers or nurses with expert advice or to check in and make sure you're doing things right. They're just there to support you. So, yeah, they're like your personal angel.
And they have wings, so.
Yes.
You use the term fourth trimester, which is an oxymoron since, you know, tri is three. But so what is it that you're referring to in the phases of pregnancy? What is the, you know, fourth trimester?
Right, right. So the oxymoron is sort of intentional to call attention to the fact that we as humans, we're, as far as I know, unique in the sense that our babies are born pretty helpless. A lot of other species, their babies are up and walking around and feeding themselves within days or weeks of being born.
Right.
But we are, our infants, when they're born, they're not really ready to be born yet, which is why some child development experts have coined those first 3 months as the fourth trimester, because they really still need some time in the womb to continue growing and developing until they're strong enough to sit up, hold their head up, feed themselves. So it helps new caregivers prepare for that role, and it also gives a sense of how demanding and important that those first 3 months are in terms of caring for this helpless new creature who really needs 24/7 support and cuddling still, like they were getting in the womb.
What are some areas of need that you help families navigate?
Well, as I mentioned, baby wearing, that is often a lifesaver for new parents to help baby sleep and caregiver feel like they can have a little bit of a life. And it can be tricky to get the right carrier and the right fit. So we do a lot of individual work with folks figuring out how to baby wear and what works best for them and their baby. And along with that goes a lot of sort of mentoring and coaching around soothing techniques and how to different ways to soothe a crying child. So we do a lot of support around kind of the basics around infant care and baby care and how to get through those first months with the baby. And we talk a lot about social support too. And that's what one of the main things that we provide is different ways for new families to access social support, but also help them think about what kinds of connections and resources they have in their own family and friends. We have a weekly virtual new parent support group that we co-run with CBNC and the Waterbury Children's Room on Thursdays. Actually, it meets later today online. And so parents with new babies can check in. It's a facilitated group, and they can just talk to other parents with babies, share stories. So that's an example of the social support that we provide. And we also help folks who are feeling like they're struggling with their mental health. We do a lot of referrals to local mental health clinicians and help folks get the professional help they need. And we do have some financial assistance programs. Obviously, it's even more challenging to be in this vulnerable new phase of parenting if you're also struggling to make ends meet. So we have some funds for families who are in that situation, and we help them with basic needs and expenses, but also with key expenses related to that fourth trimester, like if they can't afford a baby carrier or if they really need some respite child care in order to get some sleep or look for a job or look for housing. So that kind of thing we can help out with too.
Now, Gretchen, I know the Nest is closed right now due to COVID, but what is that program?
That's our parent drop-in space. And the idea is that it can be pretty scary and overwhelming for a parent with a new baby to venture out to play groups and story times with older kids running around. If you can think back to your own time with your first precious newborn, those big snotty-nosed four-year-olds are really scary and threatening, you know?
Yep.
And it can be stressful also to breastfeed in public for the first time or to change a newborn's diaper in public for the first time. But it's also really important that parents can get out of the house and talk to other grown-ups and share stories and feel supported. So our drop-in space is specifically for parents with babies in that phase of development. So it's a small, intimate space with comfy couches. Parents can sit around the edge of the room, and we have a clean floor space where we can put down mats and babies can play in the center. We have some toys for early walkers and young toddlers, books, coffee. So it's just a really great first step out. And we always know that we're going to have to say goodbye to a family when they're child starts really racing around and coming our offices around the other side. It's sort of split into two sections. And so when a kiddo starts coming around and trying to help me and my colleagues do our jobs, we know that family is ready to move on to the family center's play groups or the library story time.
Yeah. And Gretchen and I, listeners, we should mention, we love those big four-year-old snotty-nose kids,
yes,
too.
Yes. I was talking from that specific perspective that I went through with my first one. And then with my second one, I thought it was hilarious when I saw other parents trying to shield their kids from my big, scary, snotty-nosed four-year-old. Yes.
All right. And you know, speaking of COVID, what other changes have you had to make due to the pandemic?
Well, yes, suddenly everyone was a potential threat with COVID, right? So we did have to shut down all our in-person services last March. But we had already had some experience providing virtual support because we staff a warm line for folks, for new parents, that they can call and talk to someone if they're feeling stressed or need some help. So we leveraged that experience to retrain a core group of our volunteers to stay connected to families via phone, text, or Zoom, if that worked for them. And we've had a number of families who have had that sort of lifeline to another adult during this very isolating time. So we're really proud that we were able to do that. And during the good weather last summer, we did a lot of outdoor events too, stroller walks and such. And we're looking forward to start those up again now that the weather is getting nice. And hoping to start the Nest again soon once we've got the right vaccination levels up.
Outstanding. Let's talk about those volunteers. How do you find them? How can somebody get involved? And most importantly, how do you train them to participate?
Right. Yes. Well, I'm proud to say that there are many Central Vermonters who are interested and are volunteering with us. We've always had a really strong volunteer roster, and we're always excited to have new volunteers, especially now when we'll be rebuilding a bit after the long COVID pause. Mm-hmm. So we have a site on our website all about our volunteers. There's an application that's the first step. So you can go to our website, goodbeginningscentralvt.org, and then click on For Volunteers and fill out that application. Our volunteers do go through this application process. It involves references and a background check. We're very careful about screening our volunteers. And then they do a fairly intensive initial training with staff. It includes an in-person or Zoom training as well as required reading and resources. And then one of the key things about our model is our volunteers are supported every step of the way. They can talk to staff, and that's what our program director does, spends a lot of time troubleshooting with volunteers, queuing up resources for them. They call her after a visit, and they say, this is what I'm seeing, what should I be telling the family? So they always have the support of staff. And our volunteers, I'll also say, are a really diverse group. We have a lot of retirees, which is what you might expect, but we have some great younger volunteers who do this as part of their workplace volunteering program, or who have sort of flexible jobs. They work in the arts or some sort of creative field, and so they have flexible schedules and are able to add this into their lives, and we're really grateful for all of them.
Oh, I love it. What is the Baby Circles program?
The Baby Circle is our peer support group. It's specifically for folks caring for infants or babies. And in the pre-COVID times, it happened on Wednesdays at the Nest. It was an in-person group. And now, as I mentioned, we've transitioned to a weekly virtual meeting. And it happens actually on Thursdays at 12:30 every Thursday. And we do it in partnership with the hospital and with the Waterbury Children's Room. And it's just a great way for folks to connect with other parents in the same phase of parenting and share what they're seeing, hear from other parents, know that they're not alone, kind of trade tips. And then, of course, you know, you're building those play dates for down the road when your kids get older, mm-hmm. and that support system. And, yeah.
And Good Beginnings is part of a perinatal health coalition. Can you talk about that?
Yes. We're really fortunate in Central Vermont. We have a lot of great folks who are really focused on bringing more awareness to the community about the importance of perinatal mental health, the importance of asking families how they're doing and getting them connected to support and recognizing that it is more common than we think. And this coalition of providers was formed, I want to say, about 3 years ago. And it's a great group. It's the hospital, obviously, and home health and hospice, and obviously Washington County Mental Health, and the Children's Room and the Family Center, and a whole bunch of local mental health professionals, private practice or affiliated with an organization. And we get together monthly and share resources, and we organize an annual community event called The Climb Out of the Darkness. This year it's happening the week of June 21st to 26th, and it's designed to raise awareness and build community for perinatal families and shine a light on this as a really important thing for the community to know about and to support.
And do you share any other local resources with families that come to you?
Yes, well, we get a whole bunch of different kinds of requests. A lot of folks need help connecting with childcare. We refer them to the Family Center to get started on that process. Childcare is, in, you know, is a perennial challenge for folks, so they do need to start early, and we are happy to help them with that. Financial assistance, a child development question. There's a great program called Early Intervention, and so if we're working with a family and they have concerns about their child's development, we can connect them with them. And other ways to connect with families, play groups and story times, the gamut, you name it, we do it.
Sounds like you still absolutely love being involved with the organization.
Yeah, it's just such an important and exciting time in families' lives, and it's really great to see them get the support they need and then, you know, blossom.
Yeah. Gretchen Elias is the executive director of Good Beginnings of Central Vermont. Their website is goodbeginningscentralvt.org. And Gretchen, I want to thank you so much for being on with me. And, of course, give my best to the Angels.
Thank you. Will do.
Okay. We're going to take a break for CBS News. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Cindy Sprague, who is researching Eastern rat snakes. So basically, you don't have to. And I want to let you know, Red Sox baseball this evening. The Red Sox travel to Arlington. They're going to take on the Texas Rangers. And this will be the first of a four-game series going through Sunday. Coverage tonight begins at 7:05. First pitch is at 8:05. And also a reminder that we've got 3 full harmonic hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker this afternoon. That begins at 1 o'clock. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. You never know exactly what you're going to find on a friend's Facebook post. Last week, I spotted some photos of a massive black snake and some video of their dog having a bit of a standoff with this big snake. There was also a photo of a sign that read, quote, "Have you seen a rat snake? If so, please text or call Cindy Sprague." Cindy is working with the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife to learn more about this population and to help protect them. If I had seen one of those bad boys, the big snake, I'm not sure I would have stuck around long enough to get the details from the sign. But I am interested to learn the details about the, I'm going to try this, Pantherophis alleganiensis, or something like that, the eastern rat snake. That would have been the Latin name, the genus, I guess. I don't know. Cindy Sprague, eastern rat snake researcher, is going to help me out here. She joins us now. Cindy, thanks for being on the program this morning.
I'm glad to be here, Rick.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask Cindy about the rat snake or let her know if you've observed them, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Cindy, I'd like to get to know this snake before I get too invested in it. So, first of all, how do people recognize it?
Well, it's a large black snake with a white chin. They can grow to be 6.5 feet here in Vermont. And their belly is a little bit of a loose checkerboard as you go down the belly. But, they're just a big black snake with a white chin is your best characteristics to look for.
And 6.5 feet, is that the biggest snake that we're going to encounter in Vermont?
Yes, it's our largest Vermont snake.
Wow. So how scared should I be when I encounter one?
Rick, you should not be scared at all. They're very gentle. They're non-venomous. They rarely bite. They're just a great snake.
What do they like to eat?
Well, as the name implies, they eat rodents, including rats, and they also eat small mammals and bird eggs.
All right, so I guess I'm fairly safe. And
they don't eat people.
How do they take their prey?
Well, they're constrictors. So first they'll bite it, and then they wrap around it. They coil around it hold it for like a minute or two until it can no longer breathe, and then they just eat it whole, head first.
Now, have you handled a rat snake?
Oh, I've handled many of them.
Oh, okay.
Part of my study involved capturing them and putting pit tags in them, measuring their weight and length, and so I've handled quite a few.
What got you interested in the rat snake?
Well, I've always been interested in wildlife, but after taking herpetology classes from Jim Andrews, I got really interested in snakes in general. I had never touched a snake 10 years ago, and so I was just fascinated by snakes, and then being the largest snake and in Vermont, I just found them to be, you know, my favorite ones, and being constrictors also was very curiosity to me, as well as these snakes can climb trees, so they're very arboreal, and so all of those factors just made me really intrigued with rat snakes.
Well, we had Jim Andrews on a couple of weeks ago. I know Jim can get people really fired up about herpetology, but have you always been a snake person?
Well, no. I honestly was a little bit nervous about snakes before I took these classes, and so it was really being around people like Jim and some of the other students in the class that were comfortable around snakes to make me also feel very comfortable around them.
What was it like when they, I would imagine this happens, they handed you a snake in the class?
Well, they're very, Jim handles his classes very well. So people can choose if they want to touch the snake or not. So generally you start out and you might want to just touch the snake that someone else has in their hand. And then once you get comfortable with that, you might want to hold it for a little bit. So it's a gradual process.
How long did it take you to warm up to the snake?
Well, I was really determined to get comfortable around snakes. So it didn't take me that long, but it did take me a little while with the rat snake since they're so big. It took me a little bit longer to think that I could actually handle one of those.
Oh, interesting. All right, so let's get back to that rat snake, which is you're the rat snake researcher here in Vermont. What is the range of the eastern rat snake?
So we have a couple of populations. One's down in western Rutland County, and then the population that I'm studying is in Addison County, so in Moncton, Bristol, and New Haven.
All right. And, I mean, outside Vermont, first of all, you know, how wide does the eastern rat snake, I would imagine it's in the eastern United States or eastern North America, is my guess just by the name, and it eats rats. But, you know, where else will we find the eastern rat snake?
So the range extends. We're pretty much at the northern end of the range here in Addison County, and but it extends all the way down to Florida along the east coast.
All right. And you mentioned western Rutland and Addison County. Do we know of any other populations anywhere else in the state?
No, that's it.
Wow. So are they, I don't know, protected, endangered? You know, where are they on this scale?
So they're a state-threatened species, so it means they're very rare, yeah.
Wow. All right. So what exactly is the research project that you're working on with these snakes?
So the research project, the main goal was to find their hibernacula or their den because it's very important habitat for them. So that was really my main goal for the project. And we also, you know, sort of secondary goals were to look at home ranges for individual snakes, travel corridors, and just so that's pretty much it.
And how did this, Cindy, how did this become your thing? I mean, was it a thesis you're working on? You know, is this part of your job? What's going on here?
Well, I just saw it as an opportunity. I knew that this population of rat snakes had not been studied, and I would have the interest, and so I decided to just make it my project. I knew there was a need to study these and figure out where they were denning so that, you know, if needed, we could the state could conserve that land and help protect that population.
When did you get started on this?
Well, 34 years ago in 2017.
Oh, okay. 2017. All right. And then what will be done with the findings that you, the data, the findings that you glean from your research?
Well, I share all the information with the state. And with their reptile and amphibian atlas. And so it will be used for conservation efforts. They'll want to protect that habitat. And we haven't done any real active protection, increasing the, but improving the habitat there. But we're thinking that we may clear up some trees to make their denning areas a little sunnier and that type of thing.
What is like the nice denning area for them? Describe where they like to den these eastern rat snakes.
So they're sort of looking for sort of microclimates that are maybe a little bit warmer than the surrounding areas. So they like talus slopes. Ideally, they would be facing southeast all the way to west and maybe even northwest. So where it gets a lot of sun and then the rocks can heat up. They also just crack in bedrock. They can go use that as hibernacula. So that type of habitat.
Okay, so they like it warm. What have they been doing all winter long? Are they about?
Oh no. they spend 6 months. They work their way down below frost in these talus slopes, and so they just stay and they hibernate communally. So they all kind of use this area, and they're just they're dormant for 6 months and then active, out and active for the other 6 months.
I dig their ethos. I could get by with a life like that. 6 months on, 6 months off. That sounds pretty good. All right, Cindy. I mentioned earlier that at the hibernacular, what would you call it, there in Addison County, there's a sign that says, call me, text me, let me know if you see some of these rat snakes. How many people have heeded your call and reached out with Rat Snake 411 for you?
Oh, my gosh. There's been great support for this.
Wow.
I get probably, maybe like 15 calls a year. I don't know if all of them are from the sign, but people are really interested, and they seem to want to report them. So it's been very helpful.
So 15 in a year, I was afraid it would be like 15 in a week, but 15 in a year is really a good number for you?
Well, they're really secretive, so they're not easy to find.
Ah.
So that's why I'm really relying on other people to help find them too, because I can search all day knowing that they're a rat there in a certain area and still not find them.
Yeah.
So they're definitely certain times of the year where I tend to get more reports. In the fall, I tend to get more, and I also have already received one. You may have mentioned this year, so they're out of their hibernacula now and moving around.
Do you have an idea of the number of rat snakes that are in that Addison County population?
No, my research is not going to be in depth enough to determine that.
Okay.
I have 14 snakes that have been pit tagged. There's so many more than that. I really don't know the total population.
So how soon do you want people to contact you with information once they've spotted a rat snake?
Well, ideally they would contact me right away. So if they texted me right away when they saw one and tell me a little bit about it and where they found it, that would be the most helpful.
Do you want them to take a picture, or is that helpful or not?
Yes, taking a picture is very helpful because that generally gives me the location, and I just can confirm that it is a rat snake. I have some signs out at the Bristol Pond area, and there's a lot of northern water snakes there that people can confuse with rat snakes, so a picture is really helpful.
How can one tell the difference between an eastern rat snake and a northern water snake?
Well, the northern water snakes are definitely rougher texture. They're heavily keeled, and they don't have that white chin that I was mentioning. So that's probably the easiest way to tell them apart.
All right. And Cindy, do you want information on rat snakes that someone sees in Rutland County, because you said that's a population there, or possibly, one that's somewhere else in the state?
I find that information interesting, but it's not really part of my project since I'm really focusing on the Addison County population. So that's what I'm most interested in.
All right. And when you go out in search of the eastern rat snake, do you go solo or with a group, when you've been contacted?
If someone contacts me, usually it's pretty spontaneous and I'll just run out there myself. But there's also been times when I'll have a group of like UVM kids that want to help out, and so we'll spend the day looking. But as far as when the call comes in, you know, I have to sort of drop what I'm doing and run out there. So it's usually just me.
So you will go out just like hunting on your own or with a group when someone doesn't call. You're going to go trolling around Addison County trying to find more rat snakes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I do a lot of active searches on my own or with other people who are interested. Just, you know, I know where they've been sighted, so I can go there and look myself. But as I mentioned, it's really, really challenging to you know, they're secretive, and so they're hard to find.
But they're six and a half feet long sometimes, Cindy. They run up trees.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All right, they got that little white spot under their chins. Hey, you've mentioned this phrase a couple times, this term, and I'd really like you to kind of explain it, what they are, and it's PIT tags.
Okay, so PIT tags stands for passive integrative transceiver, excuse me, passive integrative,
transponder?
Transponder, thank you. And so,
I'm on the team. I'm on the team.
You're on my team, Rick. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's the same thing that the veterinarians put in your pet if they want to keep track of what it is, and they have a unique number. So I can take my PIT tag reader and scan a snake, and tell if, and I'll know which one it is, or if I've captured it before. So it's very helpful in being able to identify individual snakes.
How do you tag them?
So they come with their sterilized preloaded needles, and they have the PIT tag in there. And so it's just subcutaneous, just underneath the skin, and I inject them. So put the tag right in them.
All right. And so you can't, like, track their movement from that point forward. You can just tell when you catch them again. You use a reader, and you can tell that, oh, this is Joe. I caught him, you know, back in 2018.
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, I have to recapture them again and scan them. It's the only way to do it.
Yeah. And so they probably have some kind of digital number, but do you give them names like I just did, Joe the Snake?
I do give them names.
Do you really?
Yes, I do. And if someone sights a rat snake, I let them give them the name. There's a good reason to text me or call me right there. You can name the snake.
Oh, man. I'm getting out there. I'm on this team. I love this. Naming snakes. Of course, I got to get over that fear of a big rat snake. But I know they can't hurt me, and that's a good thing. Now, you mentioned that they are in Addison County, and that's the population you're really concerned with. They're down in western Rutland County, and I know there's timber rattlers, rattlesnakes down there. I think the only venomous snakes in Vermont are those timber rattlesnakes down in Rutland County. So do the rat snake and the timber rattlers have any kind of a relationship?
Yes, they do. So down where you find both populations, both species, they will hibernate communally. So you'll find both of them in the same den.
For the same length of time? They both go, you know, 6 months and take half a year off?
I believe so, yes. I think it's pretty similar.
Wow. I like that idea. I'm not sure I want to hang out with timber rattlesnakes, though, for 6 months out of the year, so... We'll see how I do with that. Yeah. Cindy, what is the next phase of your research?
Okay, so I was able to radio track one snake who we named Warren in 2017 and 2018. And so I was able to track him back to a den. So I know where one of the dens is, but we're thinking there's probably a second den. And so the next phase is to try to radio track a second snake and track that from a different sort of portion of the range and track that one back to its den, and hopefully it's a new den.
Will they cover a lot of ground, or they kind of stay in a general area of 10 acres or something?
Well, it's pretty interesting. The one that I was able to radio track, Warren, for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
His range was only 29 acres.
Wow.
So he didn't move that far. I think that he just had the resources that he needed, you know, within that you know, fairly small area. So he'd get good food source, you know, good, you know, a lot of rats in that area. There's a lot of oaks and nuts for the rats to eat. And so they just had, he just found what he needed in that one relatively small area.
So, yeah, are these guys this smart? Will they run up a tree, shake out some acorns, and get not that smart. All right.
That's good, Rick, though. I like that.
Thank you very much. I'm really trying to be part of this team. All right. So when when you're not chasing down the rat snake, what do you do, Cindy Sprague?
So I'm actually a consulting hydrogeologist. And so I do work with anything to do with groundwater, groundwater contamination, you know, groundwater supply, like a water source for a town, that type of thing.
And if you've got work, but someone calls with a major rat snake sighting, which is a great band name, Major Rat Snake Sighting, do you keep working or do you dash to Addison County?
It really depends, Rick, on if I have a deadline or what kind of work I'm doing. But I'm self-employed, so it does give me more flexibility than probably a lot of people. So when I can, I'll run down there.
I love that. Great choice. And what do people think when you drop this bomb about what you're doing about with rat snakes at a dinner party?
It can really vary. Some people will just say, "I hate snakes," and they'll walk away from me.
But I'm not a snake.
And then they don't even want to hear about it. They
yeah.
get nervous when you're talking about snakes.
Of course.
And the other people will come around and be very intrigued about the fact that we have these large snakes right here in Vermont. So it's a real mixed bag.
All right. Well, tell them the names of the snakes. I'm a big fan of Warren now, so that's pretty great. Cindy Sprague is the Eastern Rat Snake Researcher in Vermont, and I think she has a business card to prove it. If you spot some of these snakes in Addison County, call or text her at 802-324-5450, and you can email her at cindys@madriver.com. Cindy, thanks so much for what you're doing and telling us all about your snake pals.
You're welcome, Rick.
All right, I'm on the team. We're going to take a break for CBS News, then return for a half hour of open phone. So we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I'll be throwing out some chum of ideas, but if you got something you want to talk about, just call in. Don't forget, coming up at 11 on WDEV, it's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, Danny, let's open him up. Like he's got some big switch. Like he's at the dam, right? He's opening. Yeah, let the water go. We're going to have open phones here for the next half hour. So feel free to call in with your thoughts on just about anything. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We had the phones burning up about baseball yesterday, and I'll go back and talk about some of that stuff. Didn't find exactly what one of the listeners asked about, but found some other stuff. We talked about wild turkey hunting yesterday, and I've got some, yeah. We've got some notes from Nathan, who is on, to follow up on that. We had the Eastern rat snakes today. If you're a snake fan, let me know. Or if you're out looking for snakes or you know the Eastern rat snake, you've got one named, we'd love to hear from you. We can discuss your vaccination exploits. I got mine to relate after my second dose. I'll tell you about that. And we recently talked haiku on Friday, so if you want to give us a haiku, you know, we always love that. Of course, President Biden made a speech last night, first 100 days, families and jobs plan that he rolled out. If you got thoughts on it, you can let me know. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Those are the numbers. The toll-free number is 877-291-TALK. I like that. All right. Feel free to hop in. Where should I start? How about with wild turkey hunting from yesterday? So afterwards, Nathan LaFont wrote to me, said he wanted to mention a couple things about hunter education. So first of all, he said, let's see, the legal hunting hours for spring turkey, they end at noon daily. We didn't mention that, and that's pretty important to know. So if you are a hunter, you should know that you can only hunt those turkeys, those wild turkeys, up till noon. And for people who aren't hunters, you know, if you want to recreate during the turkey season, which is this is the month of May, it's best and safest after noon. All right. So that's a good point. The hunters cannot hunt after noon, after 12 o'clock. What else did he say? He had some hunter education information. There's a phone number you can call if you want to enroll in a hunter education course, 828-1193, 828-1193. You can always email as well, and it's huntereducation@vermont.gov, all right? And I'll have that information if you didn't catch it. But that's Nathan Lamont, who was on LaFont, who was on yesterday, talking about hunter safety, which is important when you go out there and hunt. And he's trying to coax me into it. The turkeys, the wild turkeys, that's something I would probably do. They don't seem to be too much of a struggle. I'm not sure I would do deer or moose. I wouldn't even know what to do with that. Bear meat is delicious, but again, you got to know what you're doing out there. And I don't know that I want to get that close to a bear. I'm just getting over the whole eastern rat snake thing that we talked about this morning, which I'm digging. All right. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. If there's time, I might even read a little. Did I bring that book in? Yeah. From Mim Herwig. I wonder if anybody listening remembers Mim. Miriam Herwig from down in, she was at in Randolph Center, and I got to meet her once, and that was just a joy. One of those lovely Vermonters that you'll never forget. And if anybody has a Mim Herwig story, you can always call in and let us know that too. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Remember, it's open phones, and if you don't call, then you hear me do a monologue for a half hour. And poor Danny, his head is aching just thinking of that. Oh, you got to listen to this guy. Just blow for a half hour. A half hour of him. Yeah, okay. So yesterday we had some great baseball chat, and we had someone call in and ask about the Eastern Border League, and he could not find anything on it. I could not find anything on it yet. So there was teams in Morrisville and different places. Now, there were several leagues that touched in Vermont. There was the Northeastern League, which was had a semi-pro Montpelier team back in 1887. That team finished a really sterling record of 2-13. What else? 1901 to 1907 was the Northern League. That was the first version of that. And Barry Montpelier had a team that was made up of Ivy League college players. And in 1905, the team won the championship. And I'm pulling this info off the Vermont Mountaineers website. They have a really neat history of baseball here in Vermont, so thanks to them for this. In 1923-24, the Green Mountain League had a Barry Montpelier team among its franchises. That might have been the team now. I think that's a little earlier than what our buddy was talking about, but there was a team then. And then 1935-52, the Second Northern League, and this was collegiate players, and there were the Montpelier Senators. They played home games at National Life Field, which was over on the Barry Montpelier Road on the site of the current CVS Pharmacy. How cool is that? And then like I mentioned yesterday, the Twin City Trojans, and they played in Montpelier out there at the rec field. And we'll talk more about that. But we've got a call now, and we've got Jerry from Montpelier. Hey, Jerry, how you doing?
Yes, I'm doing fine. How are you?
Oh, great. Great to hear from you.
I have a question for you or your listeners.
Okay, good.
Now the Lake Monsters in Burlington are no longer pro-affiliated.
That's correct.
And we have the Mountaineers in Montpelier, or Central Vermont.
Yep.
And I'm curious if anybody out there thinks that the, I mean, where are we drawing our players from? Do they have to sign contracts? Are the Lake Monsters going to steal players from the Mountaineers and vice versa? And, you know, does it, do you think the way the Mountaineer, the way the Lake Monsters are going, that it's going to hurt the Mountaineers?
So let me try to answer this as best I can, and then anybody listening wants to chime in, they can help out. So first of all, the league that the Lake Monsters are going into is the Futures League. And the league that the Mountaineers are in, they're also in with a team from down in the Upper Valley, the Nighthawks. And so we have two Vermont teams we've had for a number of years now, probably about 4 or 5 years, and they've been able to coexist quite well. And they are in the New England College Baseball League. Now, Jerry, this is a great question, actually, and I'm going to try to explain it as if I know what I'm talking about. But there is a kind of a tier system, almost like there would be in minor league baseball, you know, where you have triple A, double A, single A, and down to rookie ball, and you have high A, low A, things like that. And you have that kind of unofficial tier system in these summer college leagues. And the top one, the granddaddy, and really the where the top players go down to the Cape League. And they've been doing that for years, and it is the best of summer college baseball. So if you're ever down on the Cape in the summer, go see a game. You'll love it. I went a few years ago and sat there watching a game, and it was fantastic. You know, you just had your lawn chairs. There wasn't much in the way of stands. And probably about the third or fourth inning, the fog rolled in, and it made pop-ups to the outfield near impossible to see. So took a break, and probably within about 20, 25 minutes, the fog rolled out, and they could resume play. And that's just the way it is down there on the Cape. But that's the top. And the we had Brian Gallagher on from the Mountaineers last week, and the NECBL is like in that next tier down. So if, let's say, you know, they're the majors, the Cape, in college summer baseball, we're the next one down, we'd be like AAA. The Futures League, I think, is down a level or two. I can't be sure. And your question about contracts, they do not sign contracts. They do not get paid. They are amateur athletes. They're college students, so they are not paid. There's not a bidding war, which, you know, between the Lake Monsters and the Mountaineers and the Nighthawks to try to get a player here from the University of Michigan or Florida State or wherever it might be. Usually you build your team through the contacts you've made through the years with college coaches. So you might know the coach at Rutgers and St. John's and Ohio University and the University of Dayton, and you have kind of a pipeline. So the manager you have here with the Mountaineers, the manager you have at the Nighthawks, the manager you have at the Lake Monsters are probably going to draw from different programs and not be competing with one another. Jerry, great question. I hope that answers it. I hope I'm semi-right in answering that. The other day we had several calls about Governor Dean Davis, and I'm not having much success finding a Dean Davis historian. So, listeners, if you know of any, or maybe you're someone who worked in his administration, or you know somebody who did, I'd love to know that. Love to do a Dean Davis show at some point. All right, our numbers again, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And on we go up to the kingdom to Newark and Allison. Hi, Allison. You there?
Good morning,
Hi, Allison. What's going on?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I'm really enjoying the diversity of topics on your show. It's wonderful. I've been learning a lot, so I really appreciate it. You've said a couple of shows that you're open to talking about the vaccine, and so I just was calling in to kind of provide my perspective and voice some of the things that I think are not being discussed enough in this state.
And absolutely.
So I'm a mother, concerned mother, and I've been asking a number of questions because I listen a lot to, I've been listening through WDEV to the weekly conferences by the governor ever since they began, just to listen into what, you know, is being said here. And one of the things I really haven't heard a lot of the reporters asking about is just talking with Dr. Levine about, you know, what is out there in terms of adverse events. You know, when I look at the VAERS reporting, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System through the CDC, and, you know, there's certainly some concerns there. I know last week one of the reporters, I think it was from NBC5, had talked about a woman that had had received, I believe it was the Pfizer, and afterwards, I think in a couple of days, she had started to have some Bell's palsy issues, and the reporter asked him, you know, what his thoughts were, Dr. Levine, regarding that, and he said that, you know, she should talk with her doctor, and, you know, he wasn't sure if she should get the second shot or what have you. And one of my concerns is in talking to some of folks here that are, you know, working in our hospitals, they don't even know what VAERS is, and they are, you know, healthcare professionals that should understand, you know, what should be going on there. And when you look at the numbers on VAERS, which my understanding from a report that was done by Harvard back in the early 2000s is that only about 1% of what's happening is reported to VAERS. And there's a number of concerns regarding miscarriages, of deaths, of cardiac issues. There's about 3,000 deaths listed right now as of April 16th. So I just really feel like there should be more information coming out about those concerns so that we can all understand and have an, you know, informed choice about what's out there. And I feel like there's always a side of this is great, this is safe, and I'm just really concerned. I mean, I had contacted the governor concerned when I heard that, you know, this was going to really be pushed as safe for pregnant women, yet there hadn't been, you know, really any studies out there for that. And what are the long-term effects? And there's some reports there of a child that died, after his mother received a vaccine, and the Pfizer vaccine a couple days later, he was being breastfed and he got blood clots. So I just really feel like there needs to be more information. There's actually a House bill out there that's sponsored by Representative Vicki Strong from our area that she's been trying to get through for 3 years that's related to, you know, having VAERS reporting to the Vermont legislature every year, just so that we understand what's out there. So I just really feel like, you know, knowledge is power, and we just really need to hear, what's happening. And I've just been disappointed that unless asked, and I don't think that the media is doing a good job, you know, nothing's going to be happening. In addition, one of my other concerns is the discrimination that's going to be happening. I mean, you know, everybody talks about, oh, this is great. The kids will be able to go to their prom. They'll be able to go to graduation, but, you know, only if they're vaccinated. And I just am very concerned about mental health in this state right now. So that's what I wanted to say. And, I'm willing to answer any questions if you have any. But I just really feel it's important to get some other opinions out there.
Allison, I appreciate your opinion. I certainly don't have answers to your questions, but I will have tomorrow a professor from Dartmouth College who's part of the Dear Pandemic Group, which is, I think, about a dozen women across the country who have been studying this. Granted, your points are fantastic, but when you ask about long-term effects, I'm not sure we're going to know that for a while, obviously, because of this vaccine being as new as it is, also being rolled out in an emergency during a worldwide pandemic. And, having to, and you're probably going to say, my gosh, right, we're taking shortcuts. We are. And the rationale and that the CDC, that we hear from Dr. Levine is, let's look at in balance, what is better off in the long run. We've lost a lot of lives to COVID-19, and number of people who have had the reaction with blood clots, much smaller. And so in balance, we forge ahead with this vaccine. Is it right? Who knows? You ask valid questions, questions that need to be asked. I'm not sure when we'll get those answers because of the long-term research that needs to be done. Going to sneak one more call in. Let's go to Corinth and Wade. Morning, Wade. What's going on?
Good morning. Well, I'd like to lighten the conversation a little bit. And
sure.
Just a two-part anecdotal turkey conversation.
Absolutely.
And I have kids that ride in my minibuses. It's alternative or special needs transportation. And I had just yesterday a 10-year-old talking about getting his first youth turkey last weekend.
Oh, wow.
And the excitement that was, with it. It's something he did with his dad and the family, and the little brother tagged along, and the excitement, the whole conversation. And then to parallel that on the other end of the spectrum, a few years ago when turkey hunting first really picked up again in the state, I had an auto repair, and I did the work on a car of a retired from Southern Connecticut outside of New York City Wall Street investment banker that had moved up here. And he said the most challenging, exciting thing he had ever done in his life was call in his first tom and get his first turkey.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So whether you're 10 or you're 70, and from both ends of the spectrum, and I'm not a hunter. I've never turkey hunted. I hunt occasionally and fish much as I can, but I've never done turkey hunting, and I think something I might take it up after hearing a couple of those stories.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Nathan LaFont, who was on yesterday, invited me to take a hunter safety course, which would be educational no matter if I'm going to hunt or not, also thought, getting out and doing a wild turkey hunt wouldn't be too strenuous. Might be something I would enjoy. So,
and a couple of other turkeys were Governor Jim Douglas and Rusty DeWeese on Charlie's Travels there the other day. That was something else. That's a pretty hard act to follow. I don't know if they're going to go on tour together or not, but they'd be quite a vaudeville act.
Yeah, what people don't always realize until they get to know Governor Douglas is the wicked wry sense of humor that man has, right?
To have Rusty on one end and Jim Douglas on the other end of the line was something else. I think they could put it together a pretty good act.
Oh, that's brilliant. Wade, hey, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Have a good weekend.
All right. That's going to do it for today. I want to thank everyone for listening and for calling in. Again, very interesting to get your calls. I love hearing from you. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro and directed by Danny McGivrigan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. What do we got up next? Bill Sayre with Common Sense Radio is just ahead. And don't forget, 1 o'clock, 3 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.